Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. And it's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Lixidam Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. Israel has made a rare intervention into Labor Party politics here in Australia, with its ambassador weighing in on a draft wording of the party's national platform. We're going to explain what's going on and also put questions to a senior Labor government minister.
Have you seen the draft text that's being referred to there, and do you support it?
The platform will be debated and is a matter for national conference. In terms of the government's position, we couldn't have been clearer.
Then, new data from Border Force reveals the amount of illicit tobacco products being seized on the way into Australia. They'll share the details with us too. And with the arrival of a new British Prime Minister, we will find out what Andy Burnham has in store for Britain.
I have just come from Buckingham Palace, where I have accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. So it's definitely not the biggest headline in the world right now, but this is a really interesting story that we're able to drill down into this morning. Israel's ambassador to Australia has weighed in on a draft wording in the Labor Party's national platform, suggesting that it uses one-sided language about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. It's a pretty unusual story, so let's dive straight into an explanation from our political correspondent, Tom Crowley.
Tom, tell us about this. What language in the draft platform has sparked this reaction?
Well, it's a new section, Sally, that's floating around in, I guess it's important to peek behind the scenes here, a PDF version that has been floating around among media circles and clearly has made its way to the desk of Israel's ambassador to Australia. It's not a document that we know the official status of as such, and it's not a document that, for instance, the Prime Minister has owned or spoken about, but it is a draft that has been the subject of extensive media reporting. And there's a much larger section on Israel and Palestine and the conflict in general than there was the last time. If you cast back to 2023, it was quite a short section that really just said, we support a two-state solution, we call for the recognition of a Palestinian state, and we hope that this will be a priority for a federal government. Of course, Palestinian statehood was recognised by the Albanese government, so at the very least there was going to be a need to change the tensing. But there is an extended build-out of the section, and it does make a number of criticisms of Israel. Firstly, it opposes the annexation of the Palestinian territory in the West Bank, condemning settler violence and calling for an end to settlements. So this was a subject that wasn't canvassed at all before, and that's true about all of these things. It states belief in international law and says it will comply with, quote, binding decisions of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. And it notes the ICJ's advisory opinion, which relates to genocide, but the draft wording does not use the word genocide. It says that Israel should comply with obligations, let aid into Gaza, essentially. It condemns Knesset legislation on death penalty, which it says targets Palestinians. There is a new sentence inserted as well on Hamas, unreservedly condemns terrorism and violent extremism, including as perpetrated by Hamas and other extremists. But that's all that it says on that part, and that's what the statement from the Israeli embassy has picked up on, says it notes that this is a draft platform, but that it presents what it believes is a one-sided, risks placing responsibility for the conflict on one party while giving insufficient attention to the decisions of the other. That's what it says, and goes, so I suppose, particularly to whether there should be language about whether Hamas should disarm or should play no role in a future Palestinian state. The statement from the Israeli embassy also suggests that settler violence, which it places in inverted commas, receives disproportionate attention. That's a quote. It suggests that international courts are, quote, biased against Israel, and it would like the government to go further in its criticism of Hamas. Now, again, it's unclear the status of this draft, and it's not something that front benches have responded to. There has been media reporting that the Labour for Palestine activist group would like to go further in terms of the criticism on Israel, for instance, with some sanctions, but also that the Labour right would like to go further with language on anti-Semitism. A couple of brief mentions of anti-Semitism have been inserted into this draft, but perhaps a more built-out section. So there's more to come on this, Sally.
Tom Crowley there. Well, we did more on it straight away. Later on in the morning, Sally interviewed Amanda Rishworth, the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. They spoke about a whole number of things that would be up for discussion at the Labour Party National Conference, including AI, but also this intervention from Israel. Here is what Sally asked her.
The Israeli embassy in Australia says the draft national platform for Labor risks, quote, placing responsibility for the conflict on one party while giving insufficient attention to the decisions, conduct and continuing obligations of the Palestinian leadership and terrorist organisations. Have you seen the draft text that's being referred to there and do you support it?
Well, firstly, I would say that the platform will be debated and is a matter for National Conference. But if I look at what the government's position has been, we have unequivocally condemned Hamas, including for the atrocities of the 7th of October and its ongoing acts of terror. We couldn't have been more clearer. We've also very clearly said that both Israelis and Palestinians deserve to live their lives free from terror and violence. So I think in terms of the government's position, we couldn't have been clearer, but we want to see a two-state solution in which Israelis and Palestinians can live in secure borders. And I think our Prime Minister and our government's been pretty clear about that.
The draft platform refers to Israeli settler activity, aid in Gaza, the work of international courts and Israeli death penalty legislation. It does condemn Hamas, but does not call for the group's disarmament. Does that get the balance right, in your view?
Well, I think I can comment on the Australian government's position, and the Australian government has been pretty clear about taking action that will lead us closer to peace, not further away. So whether that's whatever activities they are, we want to see actions that commitments that lead us closer to peace. And that's what we're focused on because, as I said, we have been very clear that we want to see a two-state solution. In terms of the conference debate, that will be a matter for conference. But I think we can, as a government, we've been very clear about our position here.
Do you think it's appropriate for the Israeli embassy to comment on a draft copy of a party document?
Oh, look, that is entirely a matter for the Australian embassy. I can tell you that
the Israeli embassy.
The Israeli embassy, and that's entirely matter for the Israeli embassy about what they will and won't comment on. I can tell you that the national conference process is a very dynamic and exciting conference, and our focus will be really on those key issues and putting a position and a platform that puts the Labor Party in a very good position.
There have been reports that the Labor right, which you belong to, would like to build out language condemning anti-Semitism. Would you support that?
Oh, look, as I said, I think as a government, we've been very clear that we do not accept anti-Semitism. We established a Royal Commission on anti-Semitism and social cohesion, and we're seeing that play out, and it is enabling Jewish voices to be heard and their experience. So I have to say there is no place in Australia for anti-Semitism, racism, hatred or discrimination. We've been once again very clear on that. As I said, in terms of the conference proceedings, that will be a matter for players in the conference. But I very much do support the Australian government's strong stance against anti-Semitism.
And that is the Labor Party's Amanda Rishworth, the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. So as you've been hearing on the Breakfast Wrap, illicit tobacco continues to be a real headache for governments and enforcement agencies. About 80% of all tobacco and nicotine products consumed in Australia in the last year came from illicit sources, according to the most recent data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Victoria Police say they've made more than 500 arrests and have been called on to investigate almost 200 arson attacks and 6 deaths connected to illegal tobacco. Now, there's new data from the Australian Border Force that has revealed the amount of illicit tobacco products being seized. Tony Smith is the organisation's Assistant Commissioner of Customs Compliance and Enforcement, and he painted a picture for Sally about the scale of the seizures.
Tell us about this seizure data. This new numbers say that Border Force has seized more than 2,300 tonnes of illicit tobacco, 13.2 million vapes. Where and how are these items being seized? What's the picture?
Yeah, certainly, Sally. They are significant results. 2,300 tonnes of illicit tobacco in itself is an enormous amount. And the way the Australian Border Force is tackling this is by looking at this not just at the border, but by preventing illicit tobacco coming to our shores before the border, working with our international partners, but also working with our domestic partners across Australia to be able to seize illicit tobacco once it's passed the border as well. So 2,300 tonnes that have been taken and stripped out of the criminal supply chain, that's around $4.7 billion worth of duty evasion that's been stopped by the Australian Border Force last financial year. But just the perspective in terms of the pre-border, it doesn't just stop at the border. The pre-border work that we've been doing, we're leveraging all of our ABF officers that have been posted overseas working with these customs administrations. And we had over 1,640 referrals from our international partners over the course of that financial year. It's about a 209% increase in referrals when compared to last year, and almost 12 tonnes of loose leaf tobacco and 3 million vapes that were prevented from even reaching our border in the first instance.
What are the estimates about how many tonnes of illicit tobacco are coming into Australia right now?
Well, from an Australian Border Force perspective, we don't actually have insights to the actual volume. We work with our partners, or whether it's the Illicit Tobacco E-Cigarette Commissioner as well, in terms of determining what that size of the market is.
What's the key thing, I think, Sally?
Well, I haven't got the estimates from an Australian Border Force perspective, but I think that it's fair to say, Sally, that we're not getting everything that's coming through.
Where is this illicit tobacco coming from? What are the supply chains here?
Well, they diversify from time to time, but certainly right now we're seeing primarily across Southeast Asia moving through, whether it's originating from countries like Cambodia and Thailand, et cetera, and then transshipping through other ports. We have had illicit tobacco and continue to get some forms of illicit tobacco across from the Middle East as well, which is why we've established strong partnerships with the agencies in those countries to be able to detect them as they're moving through the supply chains.
Is there any sense that this market is slowing down at all?
There is. I think what we're seeing, Australian Border Force ran a specific campaign back in December for 4 months called Campaign Print War, where we amplified every effort that we could to be able to detect at the border. And in that four-month period, we detected almost 1 kiloton, that's 998.5 tonnes of illicit tobacco just in 4 months alone. But it was at that point we could see that the business model of organised crime was having to shift. Crime groups were having to be able to adjust their methodologies to be able to try and bring illicit tobacco in. So we were really making a difference. And that's that sustained enforcement pressure. It really is working.
How does this all connect into some of the violent acts that we've seen on Australian soil, fire bombings and other things? This shows that there's still a lot at stake in this market right now.
Absolutely. Organised crime will do everything they possibly can to make a profit and in unscrupulous ways. And certainly what you've just described there, Sally, is exactly the outcomes of organised crime getting involved. The illicit tobacco market is managed by organised crime within Australia that also focus on other things like weapons, border control drugs, all kinds of different criminal activities. So with the illicit tobacco market, the profits made by that, it's simply been moved across and transferred into those other commodities. But when you're engaging with organised crime, that is the outcome that illicit tobacco is going to deliver.
Do enforcement agencies have enough funding and resourcing to tackle the illicit trade at the moment?
Certainly in terms of what we, our mission, in terms of what our mission is to be able to detect pre and post border, we've got significant funding that's been given to us from the Australian government, $188.5 million that was given to the Border Force in 23-24 to be able to establish an end-to-end compliance and enforcement model, and we've absolutely delivered on that, and we've taken it steps further. So we certainly use that funding to be able to deliver the outcomes of 2,300 tonnes of illicit tobacco, and we'll continue to work with government and across government to be able to ensure that we continue that persistent enforcement approach.
Do you know what percentage of all shipping containers arriving on our shores are being x-rayed and or checked by Border Force?
Yeah, it's a valid question, Sally. We don't talk about specific percentages because it does give insights to organised crime in terms of our activities, and that's something that that's why we're successful in what we're doing. We don't stop everything at the border. It's not about if we did that, we would simply shut down the economy within Australia at the same time. It's about knowing where to look, and Australian Border Force is exceptionally good at doing that. Our targeting is very precise. We know what we're looking for, and we target the goods that we have the highest risk associated with it. And it's less about percentages that we search, but it's more about searching the right things.
Is it possible to shut down this illicit market in total?
Look, it's incredibly difficult. I think organised crime is entrenched within this market, and they'll continue to diversify their activities to make it harder to be able for us to detect them. But what we're seeing over the last couple of years with the way that the Australian Border Force is working with partner agencies, we've developed the model, whether it's through our work in the National Disruption Group, which was announced in October last year, 29 agencies, traditional and non-traditional agencies, working together across Australia to be able to disrupt the illicit tobacco market. That National Disruption Group itself seized almost 21.7 million cigarettes last year, 2.85 tonnes of loose leaf tobacco. It's about force multiplying capabilities. It's not just one agency by itself. And I think that whilst it's difficult to be able to disrupt, we're absolutely kicking goals with our partner agencies in doing that.
Tony Smith there, the Assistant Commissioner of Customs Compliance and Enforcement at the Australian Border Force. And you can find more of our coverage on illicit tobacco in last week's episodes of The Breakfast Wrap. Those are on ABC Listen.
I have just come from Buckingham Palace, where I have accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government.
The King of the North, Andy Burnham, has overnight officially become Britain's seventh Prime Minister in 10 years. He gave a speech outside 10 Downing Street saying that Britain needs to show the world it can regain stability.
I know people at home are fed up with politics. I hear you, and I want to be honest with you. We have not been good enough, and we need to be better. We will be.
Well, Andy Burnham takes over from Sir Keir Starmer, who was in the job for just 2 years. Someone who knows all about the revolving door of politics is Giles Wilkes. He's a former advisor to Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May, who was in the role for just a little longer. Giles has also advised the Liberal Democrats. He is now with the Institute of Government. And here's what Sally asked him first.
The new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, has given an ambitious speech. What did you make of it?
Well, as you say, it is ambitious. For somebody who's taken over in the middle of a difficult time, he's announced what he says is going to be a circuit breaker for the UK economy, for society. And he doesn't just mean he's going to turn around this flailing Labour government, which, in case you don't know over there, is something like third or fourth in the polls. He's talking about what he thinks is bending a curve that he thinks went the wrong way about 30 or 40 years ago, where he thinks we became too centralised as an economy, we became too deindustrialised as an economy, we haven't thought enough about the cost of living, and he wants to give power to all of the regions outside of London. So he's come in with a hugely ambitious agenda, despite the fact that, you know, he's basically got the same situation as Keir Starmer, the departing Prime Minister. In other words, not very much money and roughly the same kind of cast of characters to try and turn it around.
Andy Burnham has sacked key members of Sir Keir Starmer's previous cabinet. Tell us about some of the key appointments, particularly John Healey's been rewarded.
Yeah, this is a huge surprise. I think this morning, if you'd bet on John Healey to become the Chancellor, you've probably got 20 or 30 to 1. It wasn't on anybody's radar. Everyone thought it was the current Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood. We do not know anything about John Healey's financial or economic views, to be honest with you. He's 5.5 weeks ago, he was the Defence Secretary. He resigned in protest at what he thought was a too mean-spirited attitude towards providing money for our armed forces and investing in future weapons and so forth. And he resigned over protest, in protest over that. And as a result, sort of helped to bring down the Prime Minister. But we really don't know what he thinks about in terms of economics. We know that he's seen as a sort of a steady hand on the tiller, and he's probably going to be very loyal to Andy Burnham, and he's kind of respected by his civil servants, so it's going to be a treasury that's under reasonably solid control. But otherwise, people are scrambling around trying to find old speeches of him, his from when he, you know, was in other jobs before, to try to work out what exactly he stands for.
Giles, Andy Burnham has also pledged re-industrialisation. What is he signalling here? And is that even possible when other parts of the world, particularly Asia, can make things faster and cheaper?
It's a phrase I think we're all going to have to be very generous in our interpretation because, you know, as you say, you know, we used to be a huge manufacturing economy, the biggest in the world here, maybe 50, 60, 70 years ago. But it's been on a downward path since around 1979. It's going to be extremely difficult to keep manufacturing at the same share of the economy as it is currently, which is around 10%. However, you know, remember, Andy Burnham has been mayor of a large conurbation, Manchester. He's had practical economic experience there. He's mentioned this in previous speeches that when he talks industry, he doesn't necessarily mean heavy industry. He talked about, for example, life sciences, the healthcare industry, where Manchester has real clusters of strength, and we also have great other clusters in places like Cambridge. So I think that's one of those phrases where he's sending a signal that he wants to be active with the economy, provide good jobs, you know, really think about upskilling the country, but not necessarily that mental image we all have of heavy clanking machines. It's going to be more of those industries of the future, I suspect.
What's next for Keir Starmer as he leaves 10 Downing Street?
Well, traditionally, what happens is the departing Prime Minister heads off to enjoy a little bit of much-needed rest and recreation. I mean, when John Major was gotten rid of by the electorate in 1997, he went straight to the Oval to watch the cricket. And Keir Starmer is a huge football fan. He's going to have to wait about a month. His timing could have been a little better there because I believe there might have been a whole lot to watch a few weeks ago. But, you know, he has said himself in a very moving speech that he really wants to, his most important job in life is being with his family. He's a big family man. No doubt he's going to be doing that. And you know what? His reputation isn't shredded. A lot of people would say he wasn't right for the prime ministership, but he's a decent man who has left with his head held high. He got the message from his own MPs. But, you know, he could be somebody who is regarded as still near the top of his game, where he's good at things. And maybe an international role of some kind would suit him very well. But, you know, he really deserves a holiday now, doesn't he?
Probably not the way you'd want to start a holiday, getting booted out of your old job. Any bets on where we think he'd go for his post-prime ministerial vacation? Probably wouldn't have my money on Manchester. Anyway, that is the Breakfast Wrap for today. Thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from Sally Sarah, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. Brooke Young produced the Breakfast Wrap. And I'm Lexidum Dundon. A reminder that you can catch all of these interviews live every morning on Radio National Breakfast. That's on the wireless and also on the app. And if you are listening to the Breakfast Wrap off ABC Listen, well, firstly, you know, I've said it before, you've got to go and download ABC Listen. It's a brilliant app. It works incredibly well. You can follow all of your favourite programs, us. But if you are listening on other platforms, make sure that you're following along. And also, leave us a review. Let us know what you're thinking and what you make of the show. And you can always pass it on to family and friends too. That always helps. Anyway, see you tomorrow.